Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, with me in the studio, always with me in my studio, is my producer, Mr. Dan Arnfeld. Good afternoon, Dan.
Hello.
It's great to have you here. We're in a nice building. We have a nice studio, and hopefully there's no tornadoes coming our way. It's unfortunate what has happened in Oklahoma. I'm not trying to make any fun of it, but two cities have been wiped out, and so that's not really good. And so, but it's very windy today. It's very sunny. We had a lot of rain last night, and so it's just May. That's what it is. It's May 1st, and, you know, this is what happens. Now, for today's program, I want to continue discussing Candace Millard's book titled Hero of the Empire. Now, for those of you listening just for the first time, Miss Millard is a best-selling author whose books frequently appear on the New York Times bestseller list. She's a great historian. I know my wife is reading one of her books about the French and how they tried to get all of the artifacts out of Egypt before anyone else did. And so she's reading that book. There's another one about Theodore Roosevelt that is really good. And, you know, so actually I bought almost five of her books already because they're so good. Anyway, I need history. That's what I really need. I need to really learn history. So, anyway, on my last podcast, I began discussing part one titled Pushful the Younger. And, we got to chapter two, the chapter two is called The Graven Palm. And so on the last program, I got to page 25, and I thought what I'd do today is I wasn't able to finish all of chapter two, so I want to try and do that and finish it. But I also want to review a little bit of what we discussed last time, and I want to make a few more comments on it, and I think you'll see that there's probably a real advantage to doing this. So, remember now, we're just going to be in part one, titled Pushful the Younger. We're going to be in chapter two. Chapter is called The Graven Palm, and we'll be starting today on page 25. And we got through a lot of page 24 and 23 and 24, and a lot of that was about Winston Churchill's dad and his political career. And how Winston really wanted to support his dad, but his dad just didn't want him around. And so that was really sad. And then his dad really did some stupid things. He didn't get what he wanted, so he turned in a resignation letter thinking they could never get rid of him. And they said, okay, great, we'll see you later. And then he died 8 years later. But he was suffering from mental disability at the time, and so... So we don't want to pick on him too much. So the thing that we're really into now, at the end of bottom of page 24, is remember, Winston really, he got out of the army and he really wanted to get into politics. And things, the doors really did begin to open up for him. And, you know, he got in this situation in Oldham where... they needed another person on the ticket, and we covered some of this last time. And one of the most important people on the ticket died, so he didn't have to. He was supposed to give a speech to prove that he could be on the ticket, and it turned out he got to be on the ticket before the speech, and so it all worked out. Hopefully, I'm not getting that all mixed up. I didn't actually plan to do that today. So essentially what Winston was going to have to do was he was going to have to give this speech. And this is on top of page 25, paragraph 1. It says, the only barrier now between Churchill and his place on the conservative ticket was a trial speech. which Ashcroft suggested he give in Oldham before the campaign began in earnest. Then a final decision would be made. It was a reasonable and customary formality, but for Churchill, the uncertainty was almost unbearable. Now, you could think about this as Winston, and if you go back to my early life and read all the things that he did, it would be unbearable for him to wait. He just wanted to dig. When he was ready to go, he was ready to go. You know, he didn't want to wait for anything. And so in some ways, it led him to do something else. Now, I'm just going to go down to paragraph 2. It says, it went against every instinct Churchill had to sit still and wait to be called to the test. And so the speech was going to be his test. He says, desperate to do something, he decided that although he had faith in his star, it couldn't hurt to peer into the misty future to make sure it was still shining. And so this is where, what last time we started talking about all the things that were going on in the Victorian age. It is interesting, but I just want to make a few comments today about that. It's really dangerous to get into demonic activity. Believe me, all of you out there listening, believe me, the spirit world is real and the spirit world is evil. We have to be very careful. And so I just want to make it clear, I'm not behind palm reading and I'm not behind, mysticism. All right. So he's thinking in his mind, hey, well, maybe is there something else I could do? Miss Millard is saying, desperate to do something, he decided that although he had faith in his star, it couldn't hurt to peer into the misty future to make sure it was still shining. He was not without connections to this unusual area of expertise, and it really is unusual. He had family that they were all for him getting ahead for his career in politics. And she goes on to say, the year before, his American aunt, Leonie Jerome, had taken him to a mysterious little house on Whipple Street in the west end of London, just one block from the lushy green and stubbornly round Cavendish Square. This was home, at least temporarily, to Mrs. Charlotte Robinson, arguably the most famous palm reader of her day. Now, I know here in Edmond, Edmond's a pretty conservative little city, but there's a few palm readers in Edmond. And if you find them, they're always in these little houses on the weird streets. And so that should tell you something right there. If they're in these weird little houses and they're on back streets, it's dangerous. Stay away from it. Anyway, it's his aunt that really got him involved in this. And then, the famous palm reader. Now, we're going to come back to this in just a second. But this is one of the paragraphs that I want to just emphasize again. This is the third one down. And it says, although the Victorian era is most often associated with scientific progress, the establishment of scientific principles, the advancement of medicine, the development of railroads, steamships, telephones, radios, even the publication of Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species, it was also a time of growing interest and belief in mysticism. And, there are people out there today that still have this strong belief in mysticism, and I do not. I do not advocate it. And I want to just talk a little bit about this. I mean, when I was in college in the 70s, it was a big deal on campus then. I mean, the thing is, by the time I got into college, all the craziness over drugs was over. But the big stuff on campus was yoga, mysticism, tarot cards, all that stuff. That was the big deal. And I wanted nothing to do with it because I definitely had enough sense that it's all demonic. It was demonic stuff. Now, I'm not saying yoga is demonic, but actually physically it can be good for you. But the thing is that it's what really, really caught me on this paragraph, I'm going to read this again. It says, attempting to look into the future and to make contact with the spirit world was considered a serious pursuit by everyone, from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle to the editors of the prestigious magazine Scientific American. I'm still shocked by that. You know, Scientific American, you know, they're supposed to be like real scientists, you know. And it says Scientific American, who sponsored a contest among mediums to see who could show conclusive psychic manifestations. I mean, I watched some of this stuff when I was in college. And like I said, some of the people involved in it were the kind of crazy guys. And, you know, I stayed away from it because I hated horror movies. When I was growing up, I had older brothers and sisters, and they'd let me stay up on Saturday night and watch horror movies, and I couldn't go to sleep. And then I'd be crazy for the next couple of days. So, but this is another thing that really is kind of really shocking to me. And the thing is, I just want to bring this out for everybody, that I'm not saying that Candace Millard is even... She's not even promoting this. What she's doing is she's just giving you history of what Churchill was doing. And anyway, it goes on to say that even Queen Victoria and her husband, Prince Albert, had taken part in seances. And when Albert died in 1861 of typhoid fever, the Queen had invited to Windsor Castle a 13-year-old boy who had claimed that Prince had sent her a message through him during a family seance. And so the thing is, that really is not when you really understand England and what it's all about, the British Empire, and I mentioned this even the last podcast, that, you know, Mr. Herbert Armstrong, he knew so much about the Bible, he knew so much about prophecy, that he knew that the United States and Britain were descended from Joseph, Jacob's son Joseph. And that there was the British were going to be a great empire, world ruling empire, and the Americans were going to be one of the most powerful nations ever, and that's all in there. And Mr. Armstrong would shudder in his boots if he knew that the King and Queen of England were into mysticism, and that they're the leaders basically of Israel, modern day Israel. And of course, you know, the president who we elect in this country is also the head of one of the nations of Israel. And so what I did is I just want to show just a little part from the Bible that shows that a king of God should never be involved in mysticism. And what I'm talking about is the Witch of Endor. And if you don't know that story, it's in the book of Kings. And essentially, you know, Saul was, he was the first king of Israel that God chose. He chose Saul for Israel. And he did not obey God. He was not an obedient king. I mean, God still wanted to rule through him. And, you know, he was really, really having a tough time. And essentially, God did take him off the throne, and he put David on the throne. But Saul was really concerned about where he was going to be, and he was fighting a battle with the Philistines. And so instead of going to the prophet Samuel to ask Samuel how to help him, he went to the Witch of Endor. And essentially what the Witch of Endor was, she was a mistress. She was married, and in some ways you could almost say she was kind of like a palm reader or a tarot card reader. And essentially, you know, Saul went to her. He tried to get her to resurrect Samuel so he could ask Samuel what to do. Samuel was dead by this time. And the thing is, the spirit came up and gave a prophecy about how Saul was going to die. And so the thing is, what I'm saying to everybody out there, if you get into this stuff, you could be dealing with demons that tell you things that aren't true. And so you have to be really careful with it. And again, there is an evil spirit world out there. And so you can look that up for yourself. And again, if you just go online, It's in the Book of the Kings. And if you just get online and type the Witch of Endor, you're going to go right to an explanation of where that's from. And so, to me, again, it's not good for a king and queen of England to be involved in mysticism. And it just doesn't work right. And so, what Candace goes on to say then, I hope she doesn't mind me saying her first name. I say Miss Millard. But anyway, in paragraph 4 on page 25, it takes us a little bit further. It says, Churchill's promised Mrs. Robinson had risen to fame largely because of one of her most devoted clients, who happened to be one of England's best-known and most infamous authors, Oscar Wilde. Now, but notice that she says Churchill's chosen psalmist. So after his aunt took him to see her, he decided, yes, she's my chosen psalmist. I mean, my promised. There, it's hard to get all that together. Anyway, again, she rose because she was the chosen promise of Oscar Wilde as well. And he had gone to her and said, Robinson had told Wilde, who was already famous for his controversial and only novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray, that he would write 4 plays and then you will disappear. I cannot see you at all after that. And so this was well known. I mean, you're going to find out here in just a minute that if she got someone famous and they were really, she could really see into their future, she wanted to write it in a book. And so essentially after her prophecy is what they're saying, between the years 1892 and 1895, Wilde wrote Lady Widmere's Fan, A Woman of No Importance, An Ideal Husband, and The Importance of Being Earnest, all of which were enormous theatrical successes. In April 1895, just 2 months after his last play debuted at the St. James Theatre in London, Wilde was arrested and later convicted of gross indecency for his affair with Lord Alfred Douglas. And so if you look at that even today, I mean, comparing that with today's world, homosexuality was an illegal thing in Britain. And if you were caught doing it, you were jailed. You were put in prison. And, it's in the upper echelon, there was a lot of it going on. And so, today we allow homosexuality to just go on, and there's all the transgender stuff. There's everything going on. And they don't consider it illegal. And so, anyway, what Candace is saying is he died 3 years after leaving prison, having written, as Miss Robinson said, fourfold, no other plays. Foretold. As she foretold, he didn't write any more plays. So that's really seems what made him really, really famous. So I'm going to skip that middle paragraph there. But it was in the wakes of Wilde's conviction that Robinson gained power and prestige that set her apart from even the most celebrated palmist. She charged exorbitant rates, expecting 4 guineas for the first visit, 2 for the second, and 10 if she wrote down her prognostication. Now, I'm going to slip down to the bottom of that, of page 26 there. It says, unlike her predictions for Oscar Wilde, Mrs. Robinson saw in Winston Churchill's pale young poem so extraordinary a future that she wanted to describe it in her book. She wanted to make him famous in her book. In early May 1899, soon after taking leave of Robert Ashcroft in the House of Commons smoking room, Churchill sent Mrs. Robinson a check for, it looks like, £2, presumably in payment for a second, more recent session, and wrote in a letter labeled private that he wished to take the opportunity to compliment her on strange skill in palmistry. And in some ways, we don't know how long he frequented her, but he obviously saw her more than once. And the thing is, again, he believed in his star, but he couldn't wait to see what the star was going to give, and he was hoping this woman could give it to him. So 3 days later, he wrote her again, turning down her request to tell the story in her book, explaining that he would rather not have my hand published to the world, but confessing that he was impressed by what she had told him. I trust, he wrote cheerfully, you might be right in your forecast. And so in some ways, that was really wise on his part not to let her write all that in the book. Now, in some ways, I mean, Churchill's dead now, and Candace Millard's talking about it now. But if you're running for offices, you don't want people knowing you're going to a palm reader. That's what I think. So how are we going to fix this government? Well, let's go to a palm reader. You know, so in some ways, you know, you don't want to do that. So that was pretty wise. I know there's some other people have done, even today, have done stupid things, and they're in politics and they regret they even do it. So let's go on now. At the bottom of page 26, it says, Churchill's rise to prominence was to begin even sooner than he and perhaps Mrs. Robertson had predicted. Just a few weeks after Churchill dropped his letter in the mail, the town of Oldham, in a stunning turn of events, lost one of its representatives to sudden death. It was not, however, the aged and feeble James Oswald who had long appeared to be at death's door, and remember we covered this at the beginning of this chapter, but his robust and charismatic partner, Robert Ashcroft. Stricken with pneumonia on June 12th, Ashcroft quickly fell into a semi-conscious state. By the 18th, his doctors acknowledged that there was very little hope, and by the 19th, he was dead. There was less than a month before the election, and the Conservative Party now needed not one candidate but two. The trial speech was forgotten, and Churchill was on the ticket, whether he was ready or not. In his own mind, of course, he was more than ready. He was chomping at the bit. There's no doubt, he wrote to his mother, that if anyone can win this seat, I can. So he was really, really full of, you know, a lot of ambition. And it's just like him. And in some ways, I think it's just refreshing to have a little different view from Candace Millard and how she does things. Okay, we still have a few minutes left. And let's just slip over to chapter 3, The Scion. And essentially what I'll do is I'll cover this in more detail on our next podcast. But the word scion is really interesting. A scion is like a famous person of a family. It says, but I'll clear this up next time. I'll give you the real definition. But a few days after Robert Ashcroft's death, this is chapter 3 called The Scion, Churchill arrived in Oldham for the first time in his life. Although the town held none of the glitter of London or the mystery of Bangalore, it was gritty and real, and it had its own way powerful. Founded in the Middle Ages, Oldham had transformed during the Industrial Revolution from a tiny, thin-soiled hamlet, good for little more than grazing sheep, to a powerhouse of the textile industry, widely recognized as the cotton-spinning capital of the world. And again, this is at the time when if you really have the desire to read what Mr. Armstrong wrote about the United States and Britain in prophecy, England was coming on the scene, and they were being put on the scene by God. They were growing. They were growing in wealth, growing in shipping. They were growing in their industries. And like he said right here, Oldham became the cotton spinning capital of the world. If ever the Industrial Revolution placed a town firmly and squarely on the map of the world, a local historian would declare some 70 years later, that town is Oldham. And so it is interesting that here Churchill is getting his start in a town that really helped the Industrial Revolution move forward. It says, Churchill, however, was in Oldham for only one reason. She goes on to say, to win the election. His first speech there was to be given at the most impressive building in town, the Theatre Royal, rebuilt after a fire had burned it to the ground 20 years earlier. The theatre, a four-story red brick building, was now perched somewhat awkwardly on Horsehedge, a precariously steep cobblestone street in the middle of town. Its massive front doors, however, flanked by ornate pillars, its keystone insert with a carved bust of William Shakespeare, opened onto a lavish Italianate hall. And so the point is, you can see even Oldham, even though it may have been, you know, a sheeping country, and where they, you know, they had all the wool going, and they still had art. And they love Shakespeare. I love Shakespeare. But he goes on, she goes on to say, inside, three horseshoe-shaped galleries faced a curtain stage, stacked one on top of another and held by 10 Corinthian columns. Although the lower galleries were ostentatiously decorated, the third was noticeably more modest, and the fourth, just visible beneath a large chandelier that hung from the arch ceiling, did not even have seats, only wooden steps on which the audience seized every row. But essentially, they stood on the wooden steps. Every row from the first to the fourth was completely filled for the night's event. In fact, so great was the interest that even in this cavernous hall, there was not enough room to accommodate everyone, and hundreds of people had to be turned away. And so, essentially, this is where Winston Churchill makes his public appearance on this stage. And he's in Oldham. And so I think we're just about done with today's program. And so on our next program, again, we will continue to discuss Candace Miller's book, Hero of the Empire, Part 1, Pushful the Younger. But we're going to continue with Chapter 3, The Scion. So this book covers the details of the Boer War and Churchill's rise to great leadership. It's a wonderful supplement to Winston Churchill's book, My Early Life, and continues the history of Winston's success in politics. Now, you can buy Candace Miller's book at Amazon.com. You may be able to find a good used copy and less expensive copy at avebooks.com. Now, you should also be able to find a copy in your local bookstore. Now, of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter @JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.